Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on 101.3 KPCG online, kpcg.fm, live link at thetrumpet.com as well. This is Trumpet Radio Live. Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon back today. Feeling better?
Feel great today.
Yeah, you were a little under the weather the other day and feeling better in your back. The listeners might be curious because our little intro there, usually I say something. There's nothing said this time.
You did say something.
I did.
Was not heard by the masses.
Yeah, it didn't work out for me. But as you have more experience in radio type things, you don't try to deny it. You just admit it. Blew it. We can do.
So funny. It's almost like people thought that the show came on. And we were not even here already.
Didn't even come
the
today.
Just came on.
Yeah. We do have a lot of great stories today, by the way, and that's why you wear headphones, though, so you can hear. You're like, wait a second, I don't hear myself. So, but it all worked out now. It's taken care of. I'll blame the cold. Cold in the studio today. It's cold over the weekend, and many parts of the United States, very, very cold over the weekend. We were cold here, pretty close to record. I think we were right around, I'm not sure if we hit the record for the coldest temp, but we've been down in the single digits Saturday night, Sunday night. And the good news is, though, is that it's going to be warming up for most of the country. And the weather.com says that there's some relief from the brutally cold temperatures ahead. A change in the jet stream pattern will bring a more southerly flow and a gradual retreat of Arctic air by the middle of the week. So it's all uphill from here.
That's awesome. I heard that it was an average of about 16 degrees across the entire country. So that just shows you how cold it is in other places. If we're 11 right now, and some places like California and Florida probably aren't cold at all, that means other places are in the negatives.
Yeah, the weather map was pretty chilly. I was watching one of the football games yesterday. Oh, it was the New York Giants, and they weren't that cold. They were cold, but it wasn't that cold. And they were commenting that they were one of the few places in the country that weren't having this record cold. I think the Chicago Bears game, that was supposed to potentially be the coldest game ever at Soldier Field, and I don't know that they broke the record. It was very close, within a degree or two. So I'm not sure what the official was there. The only thing I do know is that the Packers won. Beat them.
How is that such a high-scoring game when it was freezing cold?
It was a good running game.
Yeah.
There's a lot of good runs, and so it's got to be harder to tackle people when it's colder. It just hurts more, I would think.
Oh, definitely.
And the ball's harder to kick, but that's why they're paid so much. Get out there. Get out there and deal with the cold weather. Some of the other things over the weekend, this new movie's out, Rogue One, that people are very excited about. It landed with a $290 million worldwide box office debut. That's, of course, that Star Wars movie. The audience demographics for Rogue One this weekend were 59% male, 41% female, 10% alien. No, I was kidding. 26% were between the age of 26 and 34, according to the data shared by the studio. So they keep tabs on who's buying these tickets. The U.S. opening is roughly $100 million less than the record-breaking $248 million of the Star Wars The Force Awakens that made its opening weekend. But with Rogue One's being Disney's first Star Wars spinoff, the premiere is pretty good. They made $290 million globally, but here in the U.S., I forget, it wasn't the record. So, and it hasn't opened in China yet. There's a lot of people in China, so they think they're going to make some good money on this this new Rogue One movie.
And this might be the first one I've ever seen. I might actually go see this one.
You haven't seen any of the Star Wars movies?
Never.
Wow.
Isn't that incredible?
It is incredible.
I don't know how it happened. It just, Star Wars movies never came within my presence for me to view.
I think you should have a certificate of some kind.
It's so rare.
It does seem like it should be a club. You spend your whole life trying to not see them as much as possible.
Yeah, well, that would be, I guess, more of a feat if I had tried not to, but it just happened that way.
You're actually in a really good spot on that, because if I understand correctly, and I'm no big Star Wars person, I've seen them, you know, but I don't know all this stuff. I think this one is set before the first one that was made back in the
perfect
70s. It's kind of weird for me because I always think they should be like the next part of the story, but they keep jumping around. So if I understand this correctly, and people are very serious about their Star Wars, so I apologize if I'm wrong about this, but I think it's before the first one. So you're kind of just starting now. If you see this one and you like it, then you can go back to the old ones and just watch them all in order.
Right. I can watch them in time order because, yeah, that's true. A lot of them, don't they say like the fourth, fifth, and sixth are actually earlier in time order or something like that than the first three? I forget what it is, but you can't just watch one through six and expect to progress chronologically.
I'm a little confused by all of it. And
that always confused me, too. I'm like, well, why don't you just make the movies in order? Then maybe I'll see them.
Right. Well, then there's questions, too, about is it the original, from the original canon, they say.
Mm.
Or are they making up their own? People take it pretty seriously. It's amazing. If you look around on YouTube, if you're bored someday, and you look up, say something about Star Wars or Lord of the Rings or something that people really get into, the debates and the arguments over, you know, no, this isn't part of the true story. No, this is part of the story. I mean, true in the sense of the original, I guess, because it's, of course, made up. And then even with Lord of the Rings, I mean, some people study, like, the languages that they make up, the fictitious languages. I think that new Game of Thrones is similar.
Right.
People really get into that stuff, and it seems a little bit overboard to me.
Isn't that hilarious that people would actually rather learn a fake language than one that could help them in real life? People who know more than one language make more money in real life, and yet they're spending time learning a fake one that will help them with absolutely nothing.
Well, probably, except if you're in line for one of those movies and you can speak both languages, you can communicate with the super fans.
Oh, that's true.
You could, like, strategize how to get the best seats or
become the fan favorite.
Popcorn or something. You have to be the translator. Could you speak to the fans over here? Yes. So, it's hard enough to speak one language correctly, let alone learn a fictitious one. So I'm sure there's got to be a university class on that somewhere.
Oh, definitely.
Lord of the Rings or
with the
Star
way
Wars.
Things are now, there has to be a fake language class.
Sure. Or, you know, or like, what could we learn about social, you know, harmony from Star Wars? Or there's got to be something like that.
So this is the first movie made by Disney. What was the last one? Who made that one?
I don't know.
I thought that one might have been as well, but I know it was obviously well after the first six were made.
Yeah, they and it's kind of interesting because, of course, they're better at making the movies as far as the actual, you know, special effects, but they have to keep using the same sort of weapons from before. So they're like sort of better versions of the older weapons, you know. I don't know. As a kid, who didn't want a lightsaber? If you saw the movies, everybody wants a lightsaber.
Oh yeah, definitely. Even I wanted one. I had a fake one for a while.
And then, of course, as I got older, I think, wow, I'm really glad I didn't have one. Imagine all the damage you'd do. Inadvertently cut a hole in your bedroom wall. You have to explain it to your parents.
This seems like it's a little bit too hard to control.
You can't control it. You can't control that type of power. Unless
you have the Force.
Yeah. Actually, I have a memory of a very particularly spectacular event when I was a kid. It was nighttime, and we had a fog, a certain amount of fog in the air. And we discovered that you could turn on a flashlight, and it looked like a lightsaber. So for that night, that was pretty epic. And then I tried it the next night, and the conditions weren't right. They got to be just right for the flashlight lightsaber to work.
Pretty impressive. Wow.
Pretty exciting. It can cut through fog. That's about it, as far as I could tell. They're always discovering brand new species of animals, and sometimes people, too. But they found some new ones here altogether. I think it's over 100, including a rainbow-headed snake. That sounds pretty fascinating. A tiny frog and a lizard with dragon-like horns. Those are among the more than 150 new species confirmed by scientists last year in the ecologically diverse but threatened Mekong region, researchers said on Monday. That's in the area of the Tibetan Plateau through the mountains and jungles of Southeast Asia. The Mekong River helps sustain one of the most diverse regions on the planet. They've got all these animals there that they haven't discovered before, I guess. It is a threatened region to some extent, but they're finding over 100 species last year, 163 new species. They probably have been found before, but we just refound them. You know what I mean? I'm sure people locally are like, oh, yeah, that's a rainbow snake. We've had that for years. But
yeah, there has to be a lot of criteria for officially discovering certain species because, I mean, the average person probably doesn't have the means of logging what he's seen out in the wild.
Well, even in more, regular places, like just say here in Oklahoma, how often do you see something and go, what's that? It happens often enough.
And if the qualified person isn't here, then maybe it never gets officially discovered.
Yeah, there's all kinds of things. We've got, there's a few different entry points to the campus here. Sometimes you got to punch in a code to get in and access. And in the summertime, there's creatures on those early in the morning. And you put your hand out there and you're like, are you going to bite me? They're just looking at you. I don't know what they are. They might be new species.
It could be.
But probably not. But now they know my code. They're getting in and out anytime they want to. They say, of course, in total, like I mentioned, 163 new species, including 9 amphibians, 3 mammals, 11 fish, 14 reptiles, and 126 plants. Oh, boo on the plants. Okay, I want snakes and creatures. I don't want plants.
Who cares about plants?
Yeah. It says among the most eye-catching are, oh, I can't even say this word, Paraphimbrios lao, a snake. It's a snake found in the limestone of northern Laos, whose scales reflect rainbow-like colors around its head. Pretty awesome.
It's amazing that we've never seen it before. That one should stand out above the rest.
It seems like at his tail there should be a pot of gold. It's a leprechaun snake. They say in the Thai tourist island, I won't even try to pronounce that one, which has been huge development in recent decades, scientists found a lizard, I'm not going to try the scientific name, with a fearsome-looking ridge of horns down its head and back. That'd be awesome. Can you imagine stepping on that guy?
That's a villain right there.
Yeah. That's where the movie makers need to go to figure out their new bad guys.
Oh, yeah. That's how, a lot of the time, that's how you can form some of the most exciting stories. Just look at what already exists and don't try to make up something new.
That's usually what happens. You see, I don't know, some sort of alien or monster in a movie. You're like, oh, that looks like part of a lizard and part of a, they just kind of combine things. They say in the country's northern Chiang Rai province, researchers found a newt. Not Gingrich, apparently. Just a newt. I'm not sure what that is.
That's why I love his name. It's the same as an animal.
A newt with a dazzling red and black markings that they liken to a Klingon's head from the Star Trek franchise. You can tell what the scientists like watching. They're like, that's a Klingon.
They're locked in on the sci-fi.
Yeah. And they say in Cambodia and Vietnam, a new frog species was found that could fit on a fingertip. Tiny, tiny little frog.
Never gets bigger than that.
Yeah.
Huh.
So I'd like to see all these animals. But I guess the danger would be, what do? Are they poisonous? Do they do something weird that you don't expect? Even with frogs, you have to be careful. I mean, frogs can be very poisonous, depending on, you know, where they are.
A lot of times the key is the more colorful it is, too, the more poisonous it can be.
Right. Hey, look at this. You know, and it's luring you into its trap. So I don't know. That would be, I guess, if you really liked finding animals or plants, that would be a pretty great job. Walk around. I don't know if teams of researchers are there. It kind of seems like they are because of the region. And just hang out and try to find something new.
Right. And things like that really do expand the mind. It really give human beings a vision of the creator who made those things.
Yeah, somebody's got to plan it out. Make a snake that has a rainbow head.
Just infinite imagination.
And then you think about all the things that we haven't discovered under the oceans. There's a lot. I mean, there's still a lot to be discovered. And, of course, people are very excited about going into space, which makes sense. There's a lot up there to see. But there's a lot of stuff here, too, to see. So science is a really neat field if it's used the right way, and I could see that being a whole lot of fun, trying to find some new animals. When I see the new animals around here, I'll just have to draw a sketch of them. They'll look at it and be like, yeah, we've never seen anything like that because a sketch is so bad. It's not even.
It's like a stick figure.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be a lizard somehow.
All of your new animals look like stick figures. I'm not a good artist.
Imagine you being like the criminal sketcher, the suspect sketcher.
Yeah, I think actually.
Never catch anybody.
Right. I think, I want to say Far Side or one of those cartoons did that. Where it was something like that. Anyway, it's a good
joke.
Did
they arrest the wrong guy?
Everybody was stick figures. They couldn't find the guy. Here's an interesting one from today. This is a comment made by President Obama. He had an interview with NPR's Steve Inskeep, and an interview that aired Monday, today. And he said this, the president said this, among other things. He said, I can say and I can demonstrate I can document that the country is a lot better off now than it was when I took office in almost every dimension. That's a pretty bold statement. How did you do on your job? Everything's better in every way. Everything?
Wouldn't everything. We all love to live in that world, though, where we're just convinced that everything we do is like a touch of gold?
Counterpoint. just a couple of things to consider. They say by most measures, the debt has roughly doubled under this current president, President Obama.
But remember, that all started under Bush. It's his fault.
Yeah. But it is, you know, one way or the other, the debt has doubled. That is not better.
No.
Things are not better in that way. He keeps hearkening back to taking, you know, coming into office with this huge economic problem. And there was. But all that happened was the debt was doubled. And we just kicked the can down the road and made the problem even worse. So to say it's better today, maybe you can cherry pick a couple little stats and make it seem that way. But I think just common sense, just looking at the basic numbers tells you, no, it's not better by any means. It's worse. As a matter of fact, it's twice as bad as it was.
It seems like he has a way of explaining away some of the problems with the logic of it could have been so much worse than it is right now.
Yeah.
Saying, well, I'm going to blame President Bush for this. Imagine where the debt could have been if I wasn't under control somehow.
Yeah, that's been a line that's been used a lot. And I mean, anybody could say that about anything.
Right. You know,
imagine how much worse it would have been if I hadn't done such and such. And another thing to think about is just say the race relations in the country. The statistic here says nearly 70% of Americans say race relations are bad. It's a new poll. 69% of Americans say U.S. race relations are generally bad, according to a New York Times CBS News poll, meaning Americans have reached a similar level of dissatisfaction as they felt after the Rodney King verdict 24 years ago. So if I read that right, the numbers are as bad as they were 24 years ago. They had been better in between. So that's not better.
Is that Bush's fault?
Yeah, I don't remember that even coming up much in his term because it wasn't talked about very much.
Right, as it shouldn't be. The more we draw attention to race, the worse the problems get.
Yeah, and in the president's comments to NPR today, he talked a fair bit about race and some pretty inflammatory comments, you know, saying that the minority community should feel, you know, rightly, they should rightly feel that, you know, there's a discrimination in law enforcement and that type of thing. Yeah, it's stirring the pot again. But just that one statement that thing is a lot better off now than it was when I took office in almost every dimension. No, I don't think any president could probably ever say that. I mean, it's never better in every dimension. There's always probably a thing or two that aren't better. And in this case, I think there's a lot of things that aren't better.
Definitely. It just shows a lot of arrogance there, a lot of being surrounded by a bubble of people who approve of everything he does, who almost worship what he does. And so he doesn't really hear the dissenting voices.
He said I 4 times in one sentence. So, and he didn't say I. I can say and I can demonstrate and I can document. Didn't do any of it, but he said he could do those things. So that's just a pretty outlandish statement to make, and I don't think it's accurate.
Again, where is the media challenging statements like that?
Right.
That NPR reporter should have immediately checked him.
Yeah, I think he followed up with a hard-hitting question of, uh-huh. This one is out of left field, and by left I mean the radical left. Two comments today. You can put them side by side. It's just interesting. Fox News. Former President Bill Clinton mocked President-elect Donald Trump's intelligence and said angry white men helped secure his victory. So, angry white men. Same day, CNN. Oprah Winfrey had this interview with Michelle Obama. And it says, the angry black woman label that Michelle Obama has been tagged with by some is a character rooted in other people's fears, the first lady said in an interview airing Monday. Speaking with Oprah Winfrey, Obama said she was taken aback when the insulting description of her first took hold while her husband was running for president 8 years ago. She's mad. Don't call me an angry black woman. But on the other side, Trump got in because of angry white men. It seems hypocritical to me.
Right. It just shows you that today, by the new definition of racism, it can only go one way. It can only be against minorities, and if you say it against the same exact thing against white people, because they're in a position of power, somehow it's not racism.
A little more from that interview there with Oprah Winfrey, hard hitting, by the way. The first lady said, talking about this angry black woman label, she said, that was one of those things when you just sort of think, you don't even know me, you know? You just sort of feel like, wow, where did that come from? Well, what about the angry white men? Do they sort of feel like, hey, you don't know me? Where did that come from? Say the same thing.
Easily could say the same thing. And the thing is, with Mrs. Obama, she has stated things like, I've never once been proud of this country until, what was it, until her president was elected, or until her husband was elected president,
correct.
I think.
Yeah.
Things like that where she does come off as pretty mad, and she does happen to be black and a woman. So the statement that she's an angry black woman could be accurate.
Yeah, it's just interesting how that's looked at as a very offensive thing, and they say, well, you don't know me, but then on the other side say, well, you guys are all angry white men. Do you know every single person? That's a pretty general.
That's a lot harder of a statement to make or to even prove, saying it about millions of people instead of just one person.
And, of course, the irony of former President Bill Clinton talking about angry white men is he himself, I think, is sort of an angry white man at this point, isn't he?
Sure is.
Maybe he was admitting that he voted for Donald Trump. It's always interesting when somebody takes a shot at somebody else's intelligence. I mean, everybody's got their ups and downs. I don't know. It's kind of hard to sit there and be like, ah, look at that guy.
What about all the millions of white men who are furious that Mr. Trump got elected? So clearly it's not just one group of people on either side.
Yeah. I mean, and if you look at, I think if you look at the way the people voted, Mr. Donald Trump got a lot more women voters than Mitt Romney did. Mm-hmm. And I think minority votes as well. So it's not all as divisive as they're making it out to be. But when they talk about it, it does stir the division, I think. So anyway, kind of interesting. Those are some of the interviews that are coming out today. And when you just take one statement and then take another one and put them next to each other, they're not speaking the same thing.
It just shows how detached from reality the radical left is, where we can insult whoever we want to as much as we want to, and that's fine. But as soon as you insult us, well, then you're a racist.
Yeah, it's definitely divisive, that's for sure. Here's a statistic from MRC TV in relation to illegal immigration. We haven't heard a whole lot about that lately. I guess everyone's caught up in the Electoral College and Donald Trump getting voted in, which happens today. And by all appearances, that will go as planned. It says illegal immigration, there's been 1,574 per day. Border officials struggle under increasing wave of illegal migration. So the tide is getting bigger. I don't know if this is because they feel that they need to get in before President Trump takes office, or what the push is there, but it's a record high. 1,574 people per day coming across the border.
And what's the benefit there? I mean, you have to think probably about half of those people are old enough to hold jobs, and so that's about 750 jobs every day that are taken from Americans. And then the other half are children who are helpless and are going to need some form of government support along with their parents. It's not a good thing for the country.
Yeah, it's funny too, because there's been a lot of talk about, you know, minorities, I guess, feeling unsafe now that President-elect Trump is coming in. But yet people are pouring in. They're still pouring into the country. If they really were worried, I don't think they'd keep coming. But it's record numbers. So even if you look at that one thing, it looks like people aren't, they're not really afraid of anything.
Yeah, exactly. It just shows you that whatever they're fleeing is far worse than this country. Even under Mr. Trump, if they think that's the worst thing possible, they'll still be willing to come here because it's the best place in the world.
It is at the moment. CPB reported late last week that they'd caught a total of 47,214 illegal aliens at the border last month. That was up from 46,191 they'd apprehended in October, and already the first 2 months of the fiscal year 2017 have seen higher per month apprehension rates than any month in 2016, indicating a new wave of illegal immigration that rivals the surge seen during the summer of 2014. And that's when that really was big news. You remember all the video of people coming in on trains and all that stuff. And so the numbers are getting back to that level again. So we see it continue. But apparently they're supposed to be terrified, you know. Pour in here and then get terrified and then wear a safety pin.
And remember, like we always talk about, the only reason anyone would be terrified of Mr. Trump being elected is because he has pledged to enforce current immigration laws, which is the president's job. That's not been done for the last 8 years as it should have been. So now people are actually afraid that the law is going to be upheld.
Yeah. And I don't know, you know, the people started wearing that safety pin on their like jackets and stuff to say that they were, I don't know, supporting migrants or something. They were a safe person. I'm safe. And safety pins are also handy as well. Maybe they were just holding their clothes together. But
also used to hold together old-fashioned diapers. That's what makes me think of.
That is true.
Little babies.
So LeBron James, he made some headlines when he was on the cover of Sports Illustrated. Sportsman of the Year, and he had a big old safety pin on his lapel. Didn't say why, but that's the assumption. That's why he was wearing it.
Boy, he's about as liberal as they come, I tell you what.
And so that was made some headlines last week when he had the safety pin on there.
Where's the thought about these issues? Who is actually thinking about what they believe on these issues?
Well, it's just being popular, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's a popular thing to stand for. Therefore, you'll stand for mm-hmm. it. Not too many people come out, you know, and stand for something that they believe in, but that isn't popular. Because at the end of the day, I mean, what is somebody like a LeBron James trying to do? Sell some sneakers. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's, you know, and you can't blame him. I mean, he's trying to make money. I get that. But he's trying to come out. He's coming out on the popular side of every issue. He's a populist. As much as he doesn't like talking, he doesn't like populists. He is a populist.
That's actually really true. Maybe he's catering to the will of some of the people.
Yeah, well, sure. I mean, he has to, you know, if he said anything or came out in any way that was against the popular thought, then you're not going to sell your shoes. I don't like his shoes anyway, by the way. It's not comfortable. I had a pair one time that hurt my feet. I took them back to the store. I don't like these.
That's shame on you, LeBron James.
Yeah, make some better shoes. More comfortable, please. They didn't fit my feet right. I do like the Kobes, though. Very comfortable.
Oh, yeah.
And they look like snakes.
They're sleek.
Like snake skin.
They do.
Looks, oh, you need, you know,
he is a snake.
Yeah.
He's the Black Mamba.
The Black Mamba. And they have rainbow colors on them, too, so it's just like the snake that they found earlier. So I like those shoes, and I've been a fan of them. I've had a pair or two. I'll admit that. We are not sponsored by Nike or by Kobe Bryant, though we would like to be. We wouldn't turn it down. Of course, this next one happened. We were talking about animals being found. Sometimes you find them in your house, and you don't want them there. And sometimes it happens when people bring in Christmas trees into their house. They have something else on there that they're not expecting. This happened in Australia. According to professional snake catcher Barry Goldsmith, a woman in Melbourne found a tiger snake intertwined with tinsel on her Christmas tree on Sunday morning. So she was there with the tree, and the big old snake came out. That's like Garden of Eden. Similar.
There are a lot of parallels there, actually.
See, there are a lot of parallels.
A lot of deception involved.
It says she didn't panic. She just took a photo and sent it to the snake catcher. And 20 minutes later, I had a little, well, he said he had the snake.
There's a snake catcher?
Yeah, a snake catcher. He had it in a bag. And so he said, that's what you should do. Don't try to kill it because it's illegal and it's cruel. I wish I would have known that. I've killed a few snakes in my day. Not
illegal,
tiger snakes.
Illegal and cruel to kill a potential threat to your own life.
Yeah,
that makes no sense.
Yeah, I'm not a snake. I'm not a snake catcher. I'm a snake get rid of.
Snake eliminator.
Snake eliminator. Yeah. So anyway, if you got to always keep your eye out for those things, especially in Australia, because there's a lot of deadly animals there. I watched a show years ago about like the 20 deadliest animals, you know, and about 19 of them lived in Australia. And I thought, wow, I guess you got to be careful over there. A lot of dangerous things.
That's the stereotype of Australia, is that they have a lot of dangerous creatures. So much so that a lot of visitors are actually afraid of that when they visit. So native Australians will make up even more fake creatures like the drop bear and the hoop snake. And they'll say that these things are a huge threat. The drop bear just hangs in the tree and waits for you to come underneath the tree and then drops on your head. And then the hoop snake can form itself into a circle and roll down a hill to catch anyone. It can move faster than any human by rolling in a circle.
That's awesome. Yeah, I would probably believe it. I'd be gullible enough to believe it.
Most people do. I've seen the tricks at work there.
As long as you have an Australian accent and you finish the statement with mate, It's believable for some reason. That's why you always buy more at Outback than you want to. That's not authentic.
What's that thing that bloom an onion?
Yeah.
Everyone buys it.
You buy it, yeah. And it's actually, if you look at like the highest caloric meals, if you go to Outback and you do the like the bloom an onion thing and you do the, you know, steak and you get a beer and you have a dessert, you've taken enough calories for a small tribe for about a month. So there's a lot going on there. Key David program's coming up here in a bit on KPCG. Two episodes today. Make sure you listen for those. And also the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Stephen Fleury, here from Edmond, Oklahoma today, in town for a few weeks, and braved the cold to come in and do the program. So hopefully you caught it live. If you didn't catch it live, you can catch the replays or get the archives online at kpcg.fm as well. Speaking of Australia, we have a comment from one of our Australian listeners about the monkey bread. You remember the monkey bread? Oh, by the way, Abraham Blondeau's here too, so welcome.
Thank you. Yes.
I wanted to get you in on this conversation. I thought I should announce your presence. yeah. This is the comment. It says, morning TRL team. That would be us. Last Thursday, you spoke on the show about monkey bread, and a comment was made that it sounds like something from Australia. Attached photo confirms that it is true. So they sent us a photo in of this bakery there, and let me find it.
Hey, I guessed Australia. I'll take credit for that.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
It's a bakery. Of course, Australia, so there's a guy there with swim shorts and no shirt on. And it says the Flower Monkey Bakery. And it's got a monkey face on it. So that's a real deal.
Does Australia have monkeys? Native to Australia?
I don't know. It's a great question.
They claim them, at least.
It should be the Koala Bakery, shouldn't it?
That's right, yeah.
They have koalas there.
Yes.
Yeah.
I should ask my sister. She lives there.
Yeah.
I just talked to her yesterday, but she's never mentioned monkey bread before.
You got to send her out to this place, because everybody knows everybody in Australia, right? Yeah.
Yes.
people do that. They're like, oh, you're from America. Do you know John? You're like, well, there's a lot of Johns in America.
Yes, I know John. A John.
A John. Not the one you know, but... So, yeah, you have to send her to the Flower Monkey Bakery and check it out. I'd probably stop there just because it's a cute monkey on the front. And they've got the phone number. Maybe I'll call them later.
Is it Harambe?
Yeah. Well, it's just the head, so who knows. But we appreciate that feedback from Australia. We have listeners online at kpcg.fm. If you'd like to jump in the mix on that, you can send us some emails, comments at kpcg.fm. .fm, you can follow us on Twitter at KPCGFM as well. We had some comments about the story we had last Friday from National Geographic as well. You remember that one about the transgender movement?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And shocking story.
Yeah, quite a few comments about how people are it's overwhelming, the push in that direction. And so, anyway, some good comments about that. Thank you for sending those in. And, yeah, that's their new upcoming issue, I guess.
Yeah, they had a big promo tweet of it on Friday. Oh. But it was after our show aired.
They must have been listening.
Yeah, it must have been a response. But it is pretty pretty shocking to have probably one of the most reputable magazines, at least it's more reputable than Rolling Stone, publishes something like that as like their front line.
That's true. The Onion's more reputable than Rolling Stone, actually.
We need to establish... a requirement of one Rolling Stone shot every program. We've been keeping up with that lately.
It's not hard. It's not hard to do. Abraham, you've got an article here from the Japan Times. This is a first. This is the first time we've ever quoted the Japan Times.
Yes.
It's an opinion piece. Asia's fight over fresh water. What's going on in that region?
Yeah, this is a really interesting article because most of the news focuses on maritime fights in Asia. South China Sea, anything in salt water. And those ones are obviously really important because they're dealing with world trade, international powers, the United States. But there's actually a silent war being fought over the freshwater in Asia. And it's interesting because the world's largest and fastest developing continent has less freshwater per capita than any other continent. So, and that makes sense, right? China and India are the two most populous countries in the world, but they also have the least amount of fresh water available to for everyone for their operations. And so these large populations are becoming somewhat of a weakness, if you will, because all these nations now are struggling over their supply of fresh water.
That's one of the things that always, you know, I think it's not on people's radar until it is, and then it really is. You know, even like say here in this region of the U.S. where sometimes we have some pretty dry summers, and that's when everyone starts thinking about the water really fast. And it's one of the, you know, we talk about oil, we talk about all these resources we need, but that's the big one. You need fresh water or you're going to have problems. And so it becomes more valuable than gold.
Yeah, exactly, because all these other resources you can find a replacement for. There's alternative sources to oil and all these things, but you can't replace water with anything else. It's probably the most valuable resource on Earth, especially fresh water. And so they're talking about this battle being fought between China, India, Pakistan, Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, the countries in Southeast Asia, and really against China, because China's really doing what they call is re-engineering transboundary water flows. So in other words, if we can look at, picture a map of Asia in your mind, you have India, then you have Tibet, and you have the big Himalayan mountains just north of India. And then moving north of that, you have the Tibetan plateau. And it's from that plateau that most of the fresh water supplies that flow down from the ice caps on the Himalayas form the rivers that supply most of Asia. So those flow north into China. They flow through China into Vietnam, into Cambodia. And then you have the Indus River that flows through Pakistan in India. So it's that Tibetan plateau that's the battleground here, because China, they've polluted most of their freshwater supplies further north. So they have to start damming up these rivers in the south in order to get fresh water. And this is a big problem because they have 16 downriver nations. So the rivers that flow through China, there are 16 nations that depend on the fresh water for drinking and other things. In the Mekong River, I'll put a disclaimer here. There are a lot of rivers. I looked up how to say them, and I can't get any of them right. But the Mekong River, it flows through China, then south into Southeast Asia, and it's the lifeblood of 60 million people. And China's starting to dam that river up.
Yeah.
So you can see the kind of the frustration and the controversy that's starting to erupt here between these different Asian nations. Because if China starts damming up all these rivers, they have, I think, almost 20 more dams they want to build. They're saving all this fresh water in China. And basically, they're becoming the power broker of water. They're the ones who will be able to basically give nation life or death. Basically, if they conform to Chinese policy or not, then they'll get water. So China, this is a huge power play for China, getting the water for themselves, but basically controlling all of Southeast Asia using fresh water.
Yeah, you couldn't have a greater grasp on power than that. And those nations are going to have to do what China says or else. And they've really been active in the water, haven't they? South China Sea, all this. I mean, they really are looking at these strategic issues. The United States doesn't care much about that. We've given up a lot of those strategic waterways. But it's still a huge issue, whether it's trade coming through those or, in this case, actually drinking the water. It's interesting you mentioned that Tibetan Plateau. We had a story about that earlier, all these new species that they're finding there. There's a lot of different species there, but again, they're all endangered. And why are they endangered? Probably because of a lot of what China is doing. As much as they talk about, or they use the whole global warming initiative make the U.S. make changes. They're not changing anything.
Yeah, that's China is one of the biggest polluters in the world. In fact, a big problem with the water is that even when they don't dam up rivers or divert their flow, they pollute them with fertilizers, biohazards, other chemicals. So people in other nations downriver are getting all of China's pollution and they can't even use the water anymore. And so it's kind of ironic that Tibet, the small nation everyone forgets about unless the Dalai Lama has something to say. Is he in Tibet or in Nepal? One of those nations.
Seems like Tibet or I think of Brad Pitt climbing mountains.
Right.
7 Years Tibet, wasn't that the name of that movie? Yeah.
Yeah. But it's kind of a forgotten country, except in people think of big Buddha temples and that sort of thing. But it's actually one of the most strategic areas in the world, especially in Asia. It's also, as you mentioned, as mankind encroaches more on it to get the resources and get control of it, a lot of the delicate habitats on there suffer too, because we're unnecessarily trying to grab power that's not theirs, especially China.
Isn't it amazing to look at the different mentalities between the West and the other nations like China? You know, over here there are certain elements that would say, oh, you know, we found a species of bird or something, therefore we have to stop this entire project that would make all this money because of this bird. You know, you could debate that back and forth. But then on the other side, they're like, oh, we don't care. Yeah, we're going to take all the water for ourselves. It'll give us absolute power, and we'll just pollute it. Yeah, they just don't care or don't think about it in the same way that we do here in the West. And that's why, whether it's this issue or any other issue, how do you negotiate with people like that? How do you make deals with people like that? Because it's two diametrically opposite ways of thinking, and they're never going to meet.
Yeah, exactly. And even if you've got Chinese history, going back to the Ming Dynasty, any length of Chinese history, people always talk about Confucius and all these other great Chinese proverbs, and those are great, but usually that's just how they deal with their own Chinese people. If you look at how China deals with all the other nations around them, I'm not the most knowledgeable person on this, but on all the major events that have happened in history, China doesn't have a great track record of diplomacy or working with people. Usually it's a matter of conquest. Either they're fighting off the Mongols or the Japanese or something, or they're trying to conquer everyone else around them. And so the reason the author here in this article makes a great point that the reason why Asia is so powerful today is because they've avoided war with each other for most of the last 70 years. Vietnam and Korea were fought against Americans, and there were some civil wars like that, but China's been able to not fight a war since Korea. So they've been able to focus their energies on infrastructure and making their power base bigger. But he says this could be, fresh water could be opening the door to more conflicts, where these peaceful stability of China is finally ripped apart. And we can see that China is really on the path to war. They're the ones who really want to start the next war by stealing U.S. Unmanned submarines,
yeah,
and stealing or diverting rivers, building a military base in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, the South China Sea. These are things that are on the path of war, and this article is just one more proof that China's amassing power for war and conquest.
Yeah, and they are, whether it's by, I don't know, negotiation, I guess it's mostly by force, they are kind of getting their way with the nations that are right around them. And those nations, in a lot of cases, would rely on the U.S., like the Philippines. And well, if we're not there to stand up to China, well, China is going to win. They just got more power, more people. So a great book, Russia and China in Prophecy. You can find that at thetrumpet.com. It goes through a lot of what's happening over in those regions. And this is a really interesting article there from the Japan Times, Asia's Fight Over Fresh Water. Grant, you've got an article for us. Kids turn violent as parents battle digital heroin addiction. It sounds like it's phone, internet, etc. Is that right? Digital heroin addiction?
That's exactly right. And this article begins with a story of a family that from an early age actually showed their son the natural beauty of the surrounding area where they lived in California, boating, camping, adventuring in the great outdoors. But it said none of these things stopped their 9-year-old son from falling down the digital rabbit hole. His first exposure to screens actually occurred when he was at public school. They had these things called edu games or educational games played on any number of a wide variety of screens. And then he'd go to his friends' houses, and his friends would have these massive TVs on which they could play violent video games. So not even at their house. They hadn't had a TV for 25 years, but yet their 9-year-old son was still developing a screen addiction.
Wow, that's that'd be quite a shock for the family, because they've done all they can to keep it out of the kids' hands. Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I think my generation, so I'm growing up in grade school in the mid-late 80s, right? I think we're kind of the first group that had the computers in the schools, and we had a computer lab.
So it was just down, and you had to go to the special room. And they were so slow and clunky that it was not more appealing than going outside and doing something. We could play Oregon Trail. I think the game took longer than the actual journey of the Oregon Trail. So, yeah, it was okay, but we were on to the next thing. But today, I mean, stuff's pretty exciting, and it can grab your attention and keep it. And it obviously is with a lot of young people.
Right, like you're saying, at least the computers were kept out of the classroom, confined to the library. Even when I was in public school, all the computers were in the library. There wasn't one in the classroom. But now, apparently, they do most of their assignments on iPads or smartphones or other devices. Their textbooks can be uploaded to screens, which really is not a good idea, because studies have shown that retention for whenever you're looking at a screen instead of a piece of paper is actually a lot worse.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. There's a lot of interesting studies about the way your brain comprehends what you read off of a page of paper versus screens. And there is a big difference there. Even if people are reading before bed, if you're reading off of a screen, in a lot of cases, that interferes with your sleep cycles. If you're reading off of a book page, it improves it. So we have technologies that are developing quickly, but they always develop a little bit ahead of what we find out about the negative impact. So you do things, and then you're like, oh, wait a second, we found out these bad things as well. And they're finding that out about some of this stuff, even if, you know, in the example of reading or trying to do assignments off of iPads or whatever.
That's right. And going back to the example of this family in the article, what happened was this kid almost overnight morphed from a child with a big spirit who loved the outdoors, loved animals, to someone who was actually violent when he didn't get to play his game. So apparently his parents let him get at least one computer game, and he would refuse to do anything else unless he could play the game. And then his mother made the mistake of using the game as a bargaining tool. So, okay, you can play the game if you do your chores, something like that. What happened, though, was whenever he didn't obey that, she'd have to take the game away, and he didn't like that. So he actually beat up his own mother.
Wow.
Yeah, he punched her into a heap, basically.
Really? How old are we talking?
9 years old. Nine. So must have been a pretty beastly 9-year-old.
Wow-wee.
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah, so they're not kidding when they say they turned violent. They really did.
Oh, yeah. And there was also another study in this article where they would give wounded combat veterans this computer game where they would, I guess, virtually shoot snowballs at these moving penguins on the screen. And they would do that instead of giving the patients morphine. And it actually made the pain go away better than morphine did. It was basically a drug more powerful than morphine on the level of heroin, this doctor is saying. That's what screen addiction can be. Although, in that case, when it takes away the pain of someone wounded in battle, that's a good thing. But what kind of effect is that having on a 7-year-old one who is overexposed to screens?
Yeah, the problem with all of those, well, one of the problems with, say, the actual drugs is the addiction. You can't stop it, and it ends up consuming your life in a lot of ways. So that is really interesting. It's an interesting example, especially because this person didn't have a lot of exposure, this child, to it until later on. I mean, I guess he's still young. But, yeah, you do see people, young people all over with these different devices. And there's different thoughts on that, again, you know. But it is interesting how it affects people. And I imagine it affects everybody a little bit differently. But still, you can see some similarities here to where you get addicted to it as a kid, especially. And then how do you break that addiction?
It's extremely difficult, that's for sure. It shows here that even ADHD rates have gone up by 50% over the last 10 years. Is that a coincidence that it's risen at the same time as now we have computers and screens in every classroom, and kids would much rather play a video game than go outside? It's really not a coincidence.
Yeah, when they talk about the attention deficit disorders, it's interesting. And I don't know a lot about it, but just in dealing with some kids that I'll deal with, my own kids or whatever, you know, sometimes kids will say, like, oh, I just can't focus on that. I'm like, really? Can you focus on this other thing you like? Well, sure. Okay. So it's just a matter of you're picking and choosing. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes kids pick and choose when to have that and when not to.
Yeah, that seems
not
like
always, but
a largely manufactured disorder, because if you have to focus on something, if it's life or death and you're able to focus on it, then that's just a matter of discipline if you're not focusing otherwise.
When we were kids, we called it being bored.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, what do you have? Do you have attention deficit disorder? No, I'm just bored. I don't want to do this anymore.
Well, it was when I was in junior high, so like grade 7 to 9.
Back in the 1930s?
Yes. There was this other program at a school, and you had to go through these tests to see if you were up to the challenge to be in this other program. So I took these tests, and this psychologist sat in a room with me, and he has asked me questions. He's like, how far is New York from London? I had no idea, so I made up a number. And then like stuff like that where you just test your knowledge and stuff. So I just sitting there answering questions, and then a week later they have a meeting with my mom about whether I made the program or not. And the psychologist was able to determine by spending about 90 minutes with me that I had an attention deficiency that I needed Ritalin right away.
Oh.
Or else. And when I was in the womb, I was formed incorrectly, so my mind was off balance. And by just spending 90 minutes with me.
What an expert.
Asking me like questions that had no context or anything. So to me, I mean, maybe I probably have a lot of problems, but with attention, it's a matter of discipline. Some people do have problems, physical problems with that, but a lot of it's just discipline, and I haven't had a problem with it. Like, no, I haven't had to take any drugs or anything like that.
Yeah.
And that's just an example of, or a bad example of how, like, tying in with this, a lot of kids develop poor discipline skills in their mind because of a lifestyle that they're living, usually at home or wherever else. And that's the cause of it. It's not something wrong with the brain physically. It's a behavioral problem.
Well, right. And I think that's what we're seeing happening is that people are doing things that humans do, which is I'm bored. I don't want to pay attention anymore, so I'm not going to do this. And instead of saying, no, you're going to, and you're going to buckle down and do it, which people used to hear more, it's like, well, you have a problem. And we need to, you know, it's not your fault. You haven't done anything wrong. You just have this issue. And I think in a lot of cases, it's just a matter of discipline. You just buckle down and do it. I don't care if you want to or not, you know. And there are things in life that are hard to focus on for all of us. I mean, if somebody gets up and starts giving me a lecture on, you know, in-depth botany or something, I'm probably going to struggle to pay attention to it. I don't think I need any drugs for it, maybe sleeping pills. But, because it's a tough subject. It's in-depth, I guess. But, people are so quick sometimes to think that it's some sort of a disability when it's just discipline in a lot of cases.
Right, and whenever kids are that young, the discipline needs to at least originate from the parents. This doctor recommends no screen exposure at all to anyone under 2 years old, and then between the ages of 2 and 5, an hour a day at most. That's what a lot of people are saying. He would even say hardly any screen interaction at all until the age of 10. So that just kind of shows you how dangerous it can be, especially when the parents aren't sitting right next to the child while the child is using a screen.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think that's good advice. And probably the difficulty there becomes what happens when they go to school or they're not under your direct control anymore. Do they go from like 0 to 100 to where it's like, oh, I never had this. Now I'm going to do it all the time. So
yeah.
It'd be interesting to see.
There does have to be some balance there, it would seem like. Because
yeah.
if the child has never seen a screen until 10 years old and then is able to access it at that time, it's like, whoa, what is this magical device?
Yeah, it seems like, I don't know. It seems like it'd be almost a little better to have a little bit if it's, you know, decent. You know, hey, you're going to watch a football game or something and then say, well, that's enough. Now we'll do something else and learn the discipline of like, yeah, you can use it a little bit. There's some good things to use, but then you don't need to do this all the time. It seems like that might be better. But I don't know. It depends on the situation, I guess.
Right. A common argument is that, well, what about kids who are going to grow up and use technology every day in their jobs, in their careers? That's the same thing, though, with driving a car. You know, obviously a 7-year-old is eventually going to drive a car, but you're not going to give the kid keys to the car at the age of 7 so that he can be better by the time he's 16. So clearly there is a time and a place for technological use, and for the most part it shouldn't really be used at a very young age.
It definitely crowds out. I mean, time is valuable, right? And the older you get, probably you realize that more because you know you're running out of it. It's valuable, and those are formative years, and
you know, you could spend a lot of time on those devices. But even if, like, if you were to say, well, it's not harmful, which I think it probably is. But even if you said, well, it's not that harmful, yeah, but what else could you be doing? Could you do something better, something more beneficial? It's about time management in a lot of ways, too.
At a young age where the kids are so capable and their minds are able to learn at such a faster rate than any of us who are older, and yet they're spending their time on a screen.
Yeah. It's always a dilemma. New technologies, new challenges that come up. It's an interesting article. Kids turn violent as parents battle digital heroin addiction. And I have seen some articles where even adults have to go to sort of a detox camp to try to get away from the technology. And it's a legit thing. Like, it's hard on them. And it doesn't seem like it should be, but it is. So anyway, it is something to consider. Those are some of the things that are going on today. Make sure you listen for the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Also, the Key of David program. Those are coming up here in a bit on KPCG. Also, Monday, brand new music for life as well. For myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau, have a great rest of your Monday. See you back here tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.